Another occasion was when I was sent out to observe on a farm. There were two farms which were terribly troublesome. One was La Louvière, and the other was one was Bouquet Farm, which was halfway, I think, between Pozières and Thiepval. And it was an awfully difficult place to find because it was rather low down in a valley. But it was a hive of iniquity and a terrible source of trouble to the infantry. They had tried time without number to capture this wretched Mouquet farm, and they couldn't do it. They were decimated every time they went. So finally it was decided to blow the place to hell. And I had to do observation officer. And I went up and got into the front line and with all the banners fixed and all like that, ready to go over. And they had an attack only that morning, which had failed lamentably. And that's why I was sent for. And I asked the infantry, where is Mouquet Farm? And they said, oh, just over there, but you can't see it from here. So I said, well, where can I see it from? And they said, well, you see, between us and Mouquet Farm is that little ridge over there, just the other side of a mini valley, and you might be able to see it from there. So I said to my signaler, come on, that's the only thing, we'll have to do it. There was a terrific amount of shelling going on, most of shrapnel, and then there came a lull, so we said, now's the time, and so we decided to go. We crouched down as low to the ground as we could, he carrying his telephone line and telephone, and we rushed along and dived down into a valley, the little wee valley between the front line and this little valley in front of No Man's Land, from which we were supposed to be able to see Mouquet Farm. And the valley was filled with dead and lying and dying who had failed in their assault that morning. It was pathetic.
Those words were being spoken by a man called Stuart Montagu Cleave, who was a British officer with one of the siege batteries of the Royal Garrison Artillery, and he's talking there about the attempt to take the German bastion, which was known to the British as Mouquet Farm, known officially as Mouquet Farm, known to the Australians as Mouquet Farm, a place that will always be enshrined in Australian history and also the final resting place of so many Germans and British soldiers too. Welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And it's Mouquet Farm that we're going to talk about this week as we listen to the words of the veterans that were there and also find out what it was like to revisit the battlefield after the guns had stopped firing when the veterans returned. But before we do that, there's a couple of things I wanted to give shameless plugs to, really. The first one is, 2026, as you will know, is the 110th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme. It seems incredible that it's now 10 years since I was amongst 10,000 people that gathered at the Thiepval Memorial to commemorate the centenary of the opening of the battle. But it's important that we continue to note these anniversaries. And to do so, the Army Benevolent Fund, the charity that I'm volunteer for, are holding a special black tie dinner in the Indian Memorial Room at the Royal Military Academy in Sandhurst. This is on Friday the 3rd of July 2026. This is such an iconic venue. So many of these officers that we talk about in the Great War were trained in this place, and today's officers are also trained there. And I will be the guest speaker after this black tie dinner. And the idea is that I'm going to talk about two or three of these incredible men that passed out through Sandhurst and what they achieved on those Somme battlefields in the summer of 1916. So there are limited places available for this. We're hoping it's going to be obviously a big fundraiser for the charity as we try and help soldiers, veterans and their families of today. The price for a ticket is £90, or if you book a table for eight, £700, a discount there for a table. Dresses, as I said, black tie with medals if you're a veteran. The evening will open at 6:45 with reception drinks in the grand entrance to the old college. And then at 7:30 p.m. we'll take our seats in the Indian Army Memorial Room for the dinner, which will also a raffle and an auction will take place. And the evening will finish at the respectable time of 10:30. So if you're interested in joining us for what hopefully will be a fantastic evening, go to the armybenevolentfunds.org website and look for the Battle of the Somme Celebration Dinner 2026, and you can book your tickets via the website. And the other thing I'll be doing publicly is in September the 21st of 2026, when I'll be guiding a tour of the Western Front, the First World War battlefields, for leisure tours. This will be a five-day tour, days 1 and 5, travel days with pick-up points across the UK. On day 2 of our tour, we'll be visiting the Somme battlefield. We'll be passing Moquet Farm, that we're going to be talking about in today's podcast. And we'll also be visiting Lochnagar Crater, the Teepval Memorial, and the Newfoundland Park, where we'll get a chance to walk in those preserved trenches there. The next day, we'll be visiting the battlefields of Arras and Vimy Ridge, and also the 1915 Loos battlefields. And on the final day of touring, we'll be heading up to Ypres, or we'll visit Tynecot Cemetery, the largest Commonwealth War Grave Cemetery of them all. We'll be visiting the nearby German cemetery at Langemark and hearing their stories. And we'll walk in the preserved trenches and the museum within Sanctuary Wood, just off the Menin Road there. And the tour will end that evening at the last post ceremony at the Menin Gate in Ypres, where if you wish, you can lay a wreath in memory of whoever you wish to remember. And if you have a family grave that you're interested in visiting along the way, then we'll do our utmost to accommodate that so you can lay a wreath or plant a wooden cross at the base of that family member if you wish to do so. So that's for later on this year. If you wish to book that, you need to go to the Ledger website, www.ledger.co.uk/battlefields, and there you'll be able to find a link to this tour. Now, Ledger do lots of these tours throughout the year, but as I say, the one I'm doing is on Monday the 21st of September 2026, and there is a code, and this will make sure that you get the right tour. And it's the tour code is 5BWF for Freddie stroke 1. I'll just repeat that. The code is 5BWF for Freddie stroke 1. And we hope to see you perhaps on one or maybe even both of those events in 2026. So a couple of times in the past, we've talked about the Australian sacrifice at Poitiers. And the next objective, having finally captured and secured the high ground there, the highest ground on the Somme, was to go down to Moquet Farm. And there were to be three Australian divisions of the 1st Anzac Corps that attacked northwards along the Poitiers Heights, that being their starting position, towards Moquet Farm. This began on the 8th of August 1916, and during that period, the Australians launched 9 separate attacks to try and capture this heavily defended German position. The Australians did manage to get in and occupy what remained of that farm several times, but they were forced back every time because of fierce German counterattacks. And during the fighting there, those three Australian divisions suffered around about 11,000 casualties in the fighting. And 3 weeks after the Australians had left, the British managed to capture the now isolated outpost. They didn't attack it in a frontal action like the Australians had done. They bypassed it. Now, it wasn't just the Australians that were attacking. The British 12th Division were involved. And this farm was then, and still is, a country residence of the owner of a local factory. And I think that the rebuilt farm, which is on a slightly different position to the original farm, they couldn't rebuild it in the same place because of the unstable ground with all the dugouts and tunnels beneath. So it's just on the other side of the farm track. It's still owned by the same family that owned it before the First World War. So what made it so difficult for the Australians and the British and finally the Canadians to attack Moquet Farm, and why was it such a good position for the Germans to defend it? Well, the attacking positions towards it were so vulnerable to be observed by German artillery observers. The Australians were perilously exposed to enemy fire, and this fire from the German artillery was particularly brutal. And the defenders, the Germans, using that system of dugouts that I mentioned a few minutes ago, which had been incorporated in the cellars beneath the farm, the Germans had therefore established a full underground network of interconnecting rooms. And this gave them ideal protection from the British, the Allied shell fire that was being fired above their heads in the open ground. Time and time again, the Australians tried to take Moquet Farm. Many of these attacks, as we know, were costly and perhaps futile. And in the Australian 21st Infantry Battalion history, it says this: "We've been in hotter holes since then, but never has the battalion suffered under intense shellfire for such long periods and with such little movement. The casualty lists bear this out. The conditions were vile. The weather being hot and everyone fully occupied on other tasks, the dead lay unburied for weeks and the stench was frightful. To come through a period such as this and then go on fighting is evidence of the temper of the British armies in general and of our unit in particular. Under the heading of the First Battle of Somme is told the story of our first and heaviest tryout, the time which is vividly imprinted in the memories of those who saw the whole show through." There was a man called Percy Nuttall. He'd been to Gallipoli the year before, where he'd been wounded three times, and by this time he'd been promoted to sergeant, and he kept a diary through the month of August. He says, "On the 12th, Revel was at 4:15 a.m. to pack up and ready to move. We marched off at 6 a.m. for Poitiers to await final instructions. Poor old Poitiers is completely razed. Dead bodies, smelling awful. Went into the firing line after a march of 4 miles through trenches razed to the ground. Fritz spotted us, turned his artillery on us and cut our battalion up. We lost a big crowd reaching our line. Dead bodies all the way up. On reaching the line, we were told to advance over one of Fritz's trenches and make another trench 250 yards ahead. At 10:30 p.m, we hopped the trenches under our barrage of fire. The lads went in line. Fritz turned his artillery on, but we were getting well dug in before he got the exact spot. We lost a few. At 12 o'clock, I buried Ray under the parapet. We awaited Fritz's counterattacks, but he was very faint-hearted and we kept him off and held our trenches. We got a few prisoners. One was handed over to me. I sent him back to work on digging a traverse. He was very eager to work and timid. At daybreak, we got simply hell when Fritz found out where we were with his artillery, and he was good to us. We did not eat or have any water, as we had no trench connecting to the rear, and all our messengers and duty fatigue men were dead or wounded. The lads were in good heart, but vicious at losing so many of our crowd. The day passed quickly. Their artillery never ceased. Dead, dying and wrecks were lying all over the place. Fritz never counterattacked on our front. The following day, the 13th, he says, "We lost a good many during the day, and when night came, I sent my platoons wounded to the rear and the prisoners. When all was fixed, we got orders to move to the left about 1,100 yards. We caught Fritz's patrol wedge-handed and we shot the patrol's 2 scouts. We let them get quite close to the parapet and fired. They were dead in the morning and the rest sneaked away." And then it started to rain on the 14th of August, making conditions even worse. And here we are sitting in a nice comfortable room in the 21st century. We can't imagine what that must have been like. He says, "Rain, mud galore. No sleep, little drink and nothing to eat. Wounded craving for a drink, but not many casualties until 3 p.m. when Fritz turned his artillery on and he did stir us up and wrecked our trenches. My platoon, who I was in charge of, lost heavily, and about 5 o'clock, 12 platoon was handed over to me, 16 strong. I was told off to count the battalion, which comprised 156 men and 3 officers unwounded. I was then put on rationing them, and the sights I saw were indescribable. We tried all day to get the wounded back, but Fritz's fire delayed operations. Burying the dead was impossible, as they still kept up a terrible fire from high explosive, howitzers and whiz-bangs. During the afternoon, word came of our relief as we were too weak to hold on any longer. All went well until 9:30 p.m. when, going through the 51st Battalion trench, the Rotters sighted us and sent up three green lights, which I knew the meaning immediately. I found myself buried under 5 feet of earth, with my neck bent on my chest, near my knees in a sitting position, my hand clasping my rifle. Another chap, Stevens, of the 51st Battalion, had my leg bent over him. His head was near my feet. I sang out a few times and then settled to my fate, which was a glimpse of the past. I also swore vengeance on the Huns, saying they had 3 solid days to get me fair and square and couldn't. Now they had to pick this rotten way. On top, the relief party was doing its best, the Huns' machine guns playing on them all the time. After an hour, I felt my equipment gripped. When I was on my last breath, due to my awkward position, up came my head, and what a relief. I immediately freed my arms and set to work burrowing for the chap near my feet, knowing where his head was. Up he came 10 minutes later. We shook hands, of course. Pleased we were. Towards the end of the Australian's experience at Moquet Farm, he said that 3rd of September 1916 reached the firing line at 11 a.m, slowly getting through communication trenches, eventually arriving at First Avenue, which was in a terrible condition, blown to pieces. We then set to work fixing it up. Dead bodies came to light galore, Germans and Australians. At 5 a.m, operations ceased as our barrage started. The rest of the brigade attacked the farm, which was a difficult job. One Jack Johnson, that's a German shell, landed on our section near me, where Australians and Germans were buried. Up they came, also killing 5 of the 52nd Battalion near me and 2 of my company. East and Green were killed and buried. I came to my senses, covered in flesh and blood, and Sergeant Edwards told me I said they'd got me. A large piece of dirt hit me in the chest and I was numb down one side. Anyway, up I got. I pulled myself from under a chap who was still alive, but had his brains protruding. I set to work digging him out, but he died 10 minutes afterwards. We passed a company of Canadians who were relieving us. I saw 6 of them go up in 1 shell burst. My captain took me to the doctor, who said my right eardrum was ruptured and said if we were not relieved, he would send me away in the morning. I was quite helpless, as I could not receive or give orders, but I did all I could, but my nerves were completely gone. Poor Greeny had both his arms and legs blown off, also his head and a large hole in his chest. East, I never saw, he was under 10 foot of earth. Also were 4 52nd Battalion chaps. Old dead bodies were mangled all over us and them. My company outlived the barrage on us, only by luck. Percy Nuttall, who wrote that diary, eventually recovered and was sent back to the war. He was promoted to lieutenant and he earned the Military Cross in the Second Battle of Villers-Bretonneux in 1918. And he was again badly wounded, this time by a bullet in his leg. But he lived until 1966, with those terrible memories still deep inside his brain. In one of the battalion diaries, I found a description of the Ferme de Moquet, as the French call it, which was written by an officer. And this was before the fighting began. They were trying to describe what it is that they were going to have to fight over. He says, a large farm belonging to a Belgian. There are 2 supply dumps and an artillery dump in it or its vicinity. There is a pipeline from the Ferme de Moquet to Tietvel. And the farm contains several wells. One telephone exchange is situated here. Under the 2 barns are 4 big cellars, with windows about a metre square above the ground, from which men standing in the cellars could fire or work machine guns. He had a good field of fire. The cellars are capable of holding 40 men. The right wing was burnt down in September 1914, and there are several small clusters of trees to the north, northwest, southwest and south of the farm in which artillery batteries are placed. And the officer had produced a map to support his notes. And on it there's one arrow that points to a barn, it says, with big cellars. Remember, each one of those cellars could hold 40 men. The journalist, Philip Gibbs, who tells us so much in his writings about the Battle of the Somme, he witnessed one of the advances by the Australian troops against the farm. And he wrote this. He said, these men knew the ground intimately and had already penetrated the ruins of the farm by a strong patrol, which went in and out some days ago, bringing back some prisoners. They were confident they could do the same thing again, although the site of the farm might be difficult to hold against hostile fire. Our guns did not fail them this morning. One of those clean-cut Australian boys with those fine, steady, truth-telling eyes which look so straight at one even after a nerve-breaking ordeal of fire, told me today that the bombardment preceding their attack was the greatest thing he'd ever heard, though he has fought under many of them before. Our shells rushed over us, he said, with a strange, loud ringing noise which pierced one's eardrums with a violent vibration. It was just marvellous. But the enemy's guns were powerful too, and he replied tremendously as soon as our own lifted and lengthened their fuses. The way across No Man's Land, which was about 200 yards, I think, was a perilous passage. There was no level ground anywhere, not a foot of it. It was all shell holes. Our men fell in and scrambled out and fell in again. Some of the holes were full of water and mud, and men plunged up to their armpits and were bogged. There was nothing in the way of trenches to take. The Germans were holding lines of shell craters. In these deep pits they had fixed their machine guns and were scattered all about in isolated groups, with little stores of bombs and rifles kept dry somehow. It was extraordinarily difficult to attack such a position because there was no definite line. So what the Germans have done here is, knowing that the British artillery was going to land on their trenches, they've moved their machine guns into the shell holes in front of and behind the trenches and are therefore relatively safe from the artillery fire. And as soon as the artillery fire lifts, they've then got this field of fire. The Australians found themselves sniped by machine guns, horrible little spasms of bullets from unknown quarters to the right and left, even behind them. By the time the line of Moquet Farm was reached, the battle was broken up into a number of separate encounters between small parties of Australians and small parties of Prussians. There were bombing duels between one man and another over a shell hole. Prussians sniped Australians and Australians Prussians at short range from the cover of craters. But in spite of all this hugger-mugger fighting, the Australians pushed forward and advance parties went into Moquet Farm and 200 yards beyond it on the other side. The farm exists only as a name. Of the farm buildings, there is nothing left but some blackened beams no higher than one of the Australian boys. The enemy, however, has his usual dugouts here, tunnelled deep and strongly protected with timbers and cement. Into one of these went a group of Australians ready for a fight and were surprised to find the place empty of human life. It was quiet there, out of the shell fire, and it was pleasant to be in a cool, dark room away from the battle. The men searched about and found cigars, which they lit and smoked. Good work, said a boy. As he spoke the words, there was a scuttle of feet and dark figures appeared in the entranceway. They were Germans, and an officer amongst them said, surrender! Surrender be damned, shouted the Australians. Surrender yourselves! Bombs were flung on both sides, but other Australians came up, and it was the Germans who surrendered. I saw one of them today, sitting on the grass and smoking a pipe, amongst some of his comrades who lay wounded among the men who'd helped to capture them. Other dugouts were being searched and other prisoners were taken. How many is still uncertain. But what is quite certain is the Australians have taken ground beyond Moquet Farm. And they've defeated Germany's best troops, the 1st Regiment of the Prussian Guards Reserve. Gibbs then goes on to describe those Germans. He says, they were sturdy and fine-looking men, as I saw some of them today, and they did not hide their joy at being alive and well-treated as wounded prisoners. One of them spoke quite freely and answered all questions put to him, though what the truth is difficult to judge. I think he told the truth according to the knowledge that had been given to him and the lessons taught by his warlords. One of the most startling statements which he made quite definitely is that the German emperor has issued a proclamation to his troops declaring that there will be no winter campaign. So from that, I suppose they thought the war was going to end in 1916. He said there was no shortage of food in Germany. And as for the soldiers, he said, at least the Prussian guards feed well. I had 2 eggs for breakfast. It is the same with all of our men. Are you glad to be out of it? I asked him. He smiled and said, it is good to be here. The Australians were giving their tobacco to these men, and there was no sign of hatred between them. It seems that the Prussian guard behaved well today with regard to the wounded and the stretcher bearers. After the battle, the bearers went out all across No Man's Land to rescue the wounded, and we allowed the same privilege to the enemy, so that parties of Germans and British came close to each other in this work of rescue, and there was no sniping. Fighting still goes on, and the exact issue is uncertain. But at the end of this Sunday, the advantage of the day lies with us, and the enemy has submitted to heavy blows. So at the beginning of this episode, we were listening to the words of Stuart Montagu Cleave, and in the next part of his interview, it became extremely emotional as he discovered finding a dead soldier holding a Bible.
When you saw this pit with all the men, the dead and the wounded, did it upset you that there were dying men there and nothing could be done?
Terribly. And I remember particularly Sergeant. He was lying on the ground and dead, and he had his hand on his Bible open. And I knew it was a Douay Bible, and from that I knew he was a Catholic. I took his address from that Bible. The shrapnel pouring over our heads, it didn't matter. And I closed his eyes and closed the book, put that in my pocket, and then we crawled back to the front line. And I sent that Bible home to his widow and kept up with her for quite a long time. That was one of my worst. And I remember when I went home and described it to my mother, she said, oh, well, she's an artist, you know. She said, well, I'd like to paint a picture of that. So we were living in Wimbledon at the time, and there were some troops billeted on the common, and Wimbledon Common. So she got hold of a sergeant there, and he very kindly posed for her in our studio in Lansdowne Road, and I had to put him in the exact position as I found that sergeant. And she drew a most marvellous portrait. She's a very good portrait painter of the ground, which I described to her, and the shell bursts. And then over it, I think we better change the subject, but she did draw and painted a beautiful picture of Christ with holding the grail in his hand. I was very glad, and eventually she gave the picture to the YMCA, who gave it to one of their places in Wales, and I'd never heard of it since. But I hope it's still in existence, because it was a very fine painting, and it was a very beautiful painting.
You can hear the raw emotion there in his voice, even though this interview was recorded more than half a century after the events that he was describing. He doesn't say who that sergeant was. I wonder whether that sergeant is still there on the battlefield, or whether he's buried in one of the nearby Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries. We'll never know. One of those stories that has no ending, I suppose. This next account comes from a British non-commissioned officer, an NCO, that was serving as a signaller with the Royal Engineers on the Western Front, and his name was Eric Catley, and he kept a diary. And in this recording, he tells us what it was like to visit the Moquet Farm area shortly after the fighting had stopped and moved on to the next objective.
We then went back by stages, marching all the way to the Somme. This did not please us at all. We were thinking of the terrible times we had there before. We got back to Conte. Again, our officer gave all the NCOs a lecture one day and said, we shall soon be going into action again on the Somme. And we are going to have a stiff time. The enemy are contesting every inch of the ground. The line this time was beyond Pozières and Moquet Farm. Thiepval, all these places we were holding. On our second visit, we left our horses in the village of Pozières, in charge of the officer's groom. This was about 10 a.m. one morning. We then struck off across the shell-swept ground to Moquet Farm. It was very wet about this time, and we were wading through mud up to the top of our boots. The enemy started to shell the ridge just in front of our front of us with 5.9s. Columns of earth went up in the air. We came across a derelict tank just before we got to Moquet Farm. It had got stuck in a shell hole and had been hit. Our officer wanted to go inside, so in we crawled, got into an awful mess, but we did not mind that. It was the first tank I had seen. You see, about 2 p.m., we got to the renowned farm. I say farm, all that was one could see was charred stumps of trees. This was the spot I had looked at through the glasses the night before the opening of the offensive. It was 5 miles from our front line then. You could see farm houses, big trees and green fields round about. Now it was nothing but desolation. There was an inch of ground that had not been torn up by shell fire, and only the 3 tree stumps remained. There was a very deep dugout there, had been constructed by the Huns. Apparently, inside one of the farm buildings, a brigade had got its headquarters there. We went down to see them. I am glad we did, for we had not been in there many minutes when Fritz started to shell the place. He knew we were using his old dugouts for some headquarters, and he let us know it was getting late in the afternoon and we had got a long journey back. All this time, Fritz continued to shower pretty heavily. The sick, the sights of that ground are too terrible to write about. British and German dead, who had laid about for days. It was almost dark when we got back to our horses. How glad I was when we reached Conte, tired and hungry.
Now, with such savage fighting in such a small area, comes no surprise to find that years later, visitors were finding evidence of what had happened there during the summer of 1916. This account, I found, was written in 1924, so 8 years later. It says, a horrible tale from the Somme. A few weeks ago, I received from an Englishman living in France a rather shocking account of a quantity of war relics in the shape of human remains which had been lying about when making a tour of the battlefields. He verified his statement with a photograph of a heap of bones and a skull. The place described was Moquet Farm, near Poitiers, familiar enough to many of us 8 years or so ago. My correspondent referred to about 2 square metres of the old battlefield, which had been left practically undisturbed since the fighting, and where half-buried bodies, bones, British and German equipment, bayonets, rifles, etc., lie in every shell hole. He had personally counted 12 Australian field boots with the socks and remains of feet in them, this close beside a lane through which his car passed. Before giving publicity to these statements, I thought it was well to hear what the Imperial War Graves Commission had to say about them. And the Commission told them that discovery of any human remains is reported to the Commission and immediately takes steps to have them properly interred. On receipt of my information about Moquet Farm, telegrams were at once sent to the local headquarters in Albert, and I have since received periodical reports of the result. The effect of the official information is that after a systematic search of the area, 6 or 7 more or less complete German soldiers have been found and various bones, but not enough to make one complete body. And what he's seeing there is direct evidence of the power of the artillery from both sides in this first industrial war in history. What they're seeing is the remains of men that had simply been blown to pieces. Another veteran returned in 1932 to Moquet Farm, and he said that nature had begun to take over the site. It said that grass covered the greasy, drab waste that used to stretch upwards to the remnants of Moquet Farm from the road between Poitiers and Teatville. But it was not green grass. The view was desolate. I was told that on hot days, a musty smell came up the nostrils. This is 1932, 16 years after the fighting had moved on. The official War Office photographer was a man called Geoffrey Malins. He was the man that filmed the Hawthorne mine being blown on the 1st of July, and he visited Moquet Farm shortly after it was captured. And in his memoirs, he described it as the most wonderful defensive point that could possibly be conceived and chosen by men who made a special study of such positions. He said the whole place had been thickly planted with machine guns that were cunningly concealed and able to cover the ground that attackers would have to cross, and there being no cover for the attackers. Although the farm and the surrounding area had been shelled continuously, this had made little impact on the German garrison, which had been in dugouts 40 or 50 feet underground. Malins actually entered the underground defences with a guide and found some of it blown in. He said it was a veritable rabbit warren, and when they came out of those underground defences, Malins found that he was actually 100 yards away from where they'd gone in. So eventually, as we know, Moquet Farm was taken, and the tension then goes on to the next ridge, and we start to talk about the Canadian actions at Regina Trench and Courcelette and places like that, which we'll return to, no doubt, in another podcast. It's the middle of September 1916, and the first Canadian mounted rifles went over the top at the grounds at the back of Moquet Farm, and they suffered heavy casualties. One of their officers was a man called Lieutenant Hart Leach, and he came from Winnipeg in Canada, and he'd just finished his law course. He was about to go into practice with his father when he enlisted for overseas service. Knowing that they were going to go into action within a few hours, many members of his company wrote notes to parents or friends. And Leach himself wrote one to his mother. And what he tried to do, I suppose, was put her mind at ease. He made light of what might lay ahead for him and his unit. But the letter was never sent. The note to Mrs. Leach was folded and placed in the soldier's small notebook. And Leach was killed on the following day. The book was picked up and placed in the kit of an English officer, who himself was later wounded. And when this officer returned to France, he was given new kit. That English officer was a man called Edgar King. He was a captain in the Dorsets. And incredibly, 12 years later, he found that letter that was never sent in his possession, and he sent it to Captain Leach's father in Winnipeg. This is what that Canadian man, Leach, intended to write to her. He did write to his mum, but the letter she never received. September the 13th, 1916. Dear Mother, just a wee note. I'm going over the parapet, and the chances of a subaltern, he means, getting back alive are about nil. If I do get back, why, you can give me the horse laugh. So cheer up, old dear, and don't let the newspapers use you as material for a Saturday magazine feature. You know the kind, where the sweet-faced, grey-haired little mother, clutching the last letter from a boy to her breast, sobbed, "He was such a fine lad," as she furtively brushed the glistening tears from her eyes with the dish rag, etc., etc. I'm going to tell you this in case my company commander forgets. Your son is a soldier, and a doggone good one too, if he does say it himself, as I shouldn't. And if he gets pipped, I'll be doing his blooming job. In a way, it's damn funny. All the gang are writing post-mortem letters and kind of half ashamed of themselves for doing it. As one of our officers said, if I mail it and come through the show, I'll be a joke. If I tear it up and get killed, I'll be sorry I didn't send it. So there you are. There was a newspaper obituary told us more about this man, Hart Leach. Said he was a well-known vocalist. And on Wednesday, he was in the casualty list as wounded, but was reported dead yesterday. The news arrived in an official telegram from Ottawa to J. Hilliard Leach, father of the young officer. Leach was apparently killed instantly on the field, the announcement that he'd been wounded having apparently been an error. The dead officer was probably as well known in Winnipeg as any young man of his years. He'd grown up here and received his education in this city. When war broke out, he was at Grand Rapids and did not hear of the event for several weeks. When the news reached him, he set out for Winnipeg in a canoe, and after a perilous journey, he arrived in the town and at once enlisted for active service in the 90th. He entered as a private, but later took various courses of instruction to fit himself for any duties to which he might be called. He studied musketry, engineering and bombing, and took the field officer's course, which prepared him for any position. He finally entered the 61st as a lieutenant and became a musketry instructor, lecturing on this subject. He entered the School of Instruction at Shorncliffe and graduated with the highest honours. He was then sent to the front and was engaged almost incessantly in fighting until he was killed. Lieutenant Leach was recognised in the city as one of the most promising young men. As a boy, he was known as a pianist, and later he became a baritone soloist and was widely known in musical circles. He'd almost completed his course in law and would have entered the firm for which J. Hilliard Leach is the head had the war not intervened. And that was it. His body was never found. It may still be there, or perhaps it's in one of those Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries in the area, the most well-known one, the most likely one, being the Adirondack Cemetery, which is Canada spelt backwards. But whatever, he's remembered on the Vimy Ridge Memorial to the Canadians. And in a letter dated the 16th of October 1928, That meant Edgar King, the former captain of the Dorsets, wrote to Leach's father and said this: "On going through my old army valets last week, with the intention of destroying it, I felt a bulge, and slipping my hand through the torn lining, I pulled out the enclosed pocketbook. It seems a dreadful thing to reopen old wounds, but I consider it a sacred trust to forward it to you. The circumstances in which it came into my possession are briefly these. I was in the line at Moquet Farm with my regiment in September 1916. I shall not attempt to describe the incredible charnel house the scene portrayed, but at nights, even now, I have bad dreams. The shelling was so incessant night and day, and the weather was so appalling, it was practically impossible to bury the dead. Every shell hole had its complement of those who had gained Valhalla. My servant brought me this pocketbook, and I gave orders for it and any other documents and identity discs to be sent to battalion headquarters for transmission. Apparently, in the hurly-burly, he put it in my valets, being badly wounded a few days afterwards. I spent many weary months in hospital. The valets and other stuff were so badly knocked about that I took out of fresh equipment on going to France the second time. The old valets has been lying in a cupboard ever since. I trust you'll receive the pocketbook safely. In that unfinished letter, your son shows the indomitable courage and capability of laughing at death that makes the tragedy of his death the more poignant. God keep his very brave spirit. Yours sincerely, Edgar King." I wonder how his father felt when he received that letter. There's no word of what had happened to his mother at this stage. I wonder whether she was still alive and whether she read that letter 12 years after it was written, and how on earth that family coped with the reopening of old wounds. I wonder whether they'd ever recover from the loss of their such talented musician and lawyer son. As always, we wonder what he would have achieved in his life, along with all those other Canadians, Australians, British soldiers and German soldiers that died in and around Moquet Farm in that summer and early autumn of 1916. When you go there now, it's such a very peaceful, quiet place, and it's a place that so many people drive past without stopping. There are so many farmhouses scattered around the Somme, all with their own stores. And this one sits back possibly 250 yards maybe from the road, the D73 that takes you from Poisier up to Teepval. As you head up the hill, you can see Teepval appearing on the horizon on your left. And that's what people focus on. Perhaps they don't realise that on the right-hand side sits Moquet Farm. As I said earlier, it's on the other side of the farm track from where it was situated. I think I read that the present farmhouse was constructed in 1928, 12 years after the fighting. It's private land, so it's not right, it's not fair, and you shouldn't approach it at all. You can walk round it. There's a farm track that takes you from Courcelette round the back and up, joins up again with the D73 close to Teepval. And as you walk, drive or cycle in the area, you inevitably find evidence of what happened there all those years ago. And one of them is a private memorial that I stumbled upon that was placed on the 100th anniversary of the death of another Canadian soldier. It's a plaque that says, "In memory of Lance Corporal Claude Harold Cross, who was serving with C Company of the 2nd Canadian Mounted Rifle Battalion, Vancouver. And he was originally from Birmingham in England. He was killed in action on this spot during the Battle of Moquet Farm on the 16th of September 1916, aged 25 years. We shall remember them." And it says plaque was placed there by his great nephew, Charles Stimpson, on the 16th of September 2016, exactly 100 years from the day that his great uncle fell on this spot. He has no known grave. Perhaps he's also in one of those Canadian cemeteries at Courcelette or Upper Adirneck. But he's remembered also on the Vimy Memorial to the missing Canadians. But the best thing to do to view Moquet Farm, is to stop in the lay-by that's about halfway along the road between the village of Poisiers and Thiepval, you'll see, I think it's between some trees on the right-hand side, a lay-by. It's a, quite a busy road, that one, so it's a good job there is a lay-by there, because it means you can safely stop and read the memorial that was placed there in the late 1990s, I think, about 1997-98. And there's a map showing the contours of the area, showing the farm as it was during the war period. And there's quite a lot of information there as well. And on the memorial, it says Moquet Farm, situated on Poisiers Ridge, was a central bastion in the German defence position during the battles of the Somme from July to October 1916. The shattered farmhouse was then located to the left of the farm road on the crest before you. Its deep cellars and tunnels were connected to a complex network of German trenches in the fields. On the 5th of August, the Australians were first to attack the stronghold, having just incurred a devastating loss of 17,000 men in the capture of Poisiers, only 1 kilometre away. The Australians proceeded to claw their way up the slopes to Moquet Farm, each day in a nightmarish landscape deluged by artillery fire. Both sides fought to the death over small sections of trench. After a month of this combat, the exhausted Australians, with 6,300 casualties, were relieved on the 5th of September. Just outside the farm ruins by the Canadians, 25 days later, the farm fell to the British. The war would pass over this ridge again in 1918. Many of the men who fought and were lost in 1916 remain beneath this land forever, unknown, but never forgotten by their homeland, Australia. And beneath the ground they still are, because after the battle moved on, the winter came. That awful cold winter where temperatures plummeted to more than minus 20 below freezing. The ground became rock solid, and within the ground were those bodies of the fallen. And I read accounts of soldiers that were there in the following spring, as it became a rear area, as the Germans had withdrawn from the Somme. And when the thaw came, the battlefield gave up its grisly secrets to the men that now occupied these positions in what was a rear area, because the frozen, unburied dead of the fighting from August and September also thawed out and became another terrible, terrible relic of the fighting that had taken place. It is beyond our imagination to try and understand, A, what it was like to be involved in that fighting, or B, to be there in the spring when the thaw came, or even to see what happened there in 1924 in that account that we read of finding parts of bodies still there. And no doubt in the future, more of those men will be discovered. Whether or not they can identify who they are, highly unlikely, I suppose. But by listening to this podcast, we shall remember them. And hopefully you will visit the scene of Moquet Farm. You won't drive past. You'll stop, pause, read the information on that memorial, look up at the ridge where that farm once stood. All it leaves me to do is to thank you once again for tuning in to the podcast. Please do rate and review if you've enjoyed it on wherever you download it from. And I think it is appropriate this week that we do sound the last post to remember those thousands, those many thousands of young men that gave up their lives in and around Mucky, Mukau or Moquet Farm in 1960.